Our case for argument this morning is Holmes v. Buss. Mr. Benza.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I have reserved 5 minutes for my rebuttal. I would like to focus my argument this morning on two issues that are presented to the Court, the first being the current competency of Mr. Holmes to proceed in this matter, and the second being the issues regarding the prosecutorial misconduct. The issue before the Court regarding the competency is the question of what is the competency standard and the competency to do what. And that issue is whether or not Mr. Holmes is capable of assisting his counsel in the litigation regarding his habeas petition, both at the district court, in which we first raised the question of his competency, as well as before this court regarding his competency. On the second matter of current competency in this court, the issue of first has to be addressed the issue of Mr. Holmes' due process rights to the competency determination that was engaged in by the lower court when this court remanded it for that evaluation. The district court appointed the experts. Dr. Ron Bailey was the suggestion from Mr. Holmes. Dr. Olive was the suggestion from the state of Indiana. Those experts were appointed to perform competency evaluations. Before their evaluations were completed, Judge McKinney conducted a hearing at which Mr. Holmes was called to testify. Mr. Holmes provided testimony in that proceeding. That proceeding was then adjourned so that the experts could submit their final reports, in the anticipation on behalf of, I believe, Mr. Holmes and the state, that a hearing would be held in which the experts would then testify. No further proceedings were held before the district court. Counsel was not given the opportunity to present the experts for live testimony, to cross-examine or examine the experts relative to their findings, or to make any arguments on behalf of Mr. Holmes or on behalf of the state as to Mr. Holmes's current competency. And because of that matter, the district court's determination of current competency is invalid, and this matter should be remanded back to the district court for a full competency hearing so that this court can finally adjudicate whether or not Mr. Holmes is currently competent to proceed.
Mr. Benza, is it your position that the district court, who, as far as I know, doesn't have degrees in psychiatry, et cetera, or psychology, is simply unable to make a determination of competency through sitting on the bench and listening to Mr. Holmes talk?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Do you think this is something only an expert can do?
Absolutely, and we know as a matter of law that a competency evaluation or a competency determination is a medical question and must have medical testimony.
That's not true. Look, you have two problems. You have two sets of experts, neither of whom has a complete picture. So the psychiatrist can talk about this person's lucidity and whether he has a mental disease and can think straight and so on. But he doesn't know exactly how much, you know, clarity of thought you need in order to participate in a legal proceeding. That's what the judge knows. So the judge can't simply defer to the opinion of an expert. And he did, from the transcript of what Holmes said to the judge, he sounded as if he, you know, knew what was going on. And the fact that he has strange beliefs does not actually distinguish him from the rest of the society, does it?
In and of itself, no. It's only in light of the psychiatrist's testimony regarding what that belief system is causing, its causation, as well as its impact on Mr. Holmes's thought process.
Well, they have reports, and the judge looked at their reports, and then he listened to Holmes and made a judgment. I don't know what additional benefit there would be from further hearing.
Well, the benefit would be that Mr. Holmes would have the ability to have his counsel examine the witnesses, to draw out their testimony, explain their reports, answer questions to the court.
Now, did you think, for example, that had you had that opportunity vis-a-vis the state's expert, Dr. Olive, that you might have gotten him to say, you know, with a further investigation, maybe he'd be able to form a more definitive opinion? I mean, what concretely do you think such a hearing would have done for you?
The primary area that we want the opportunity to examine Dr. Olive about is to explain the content and nature of his interaction with Mr. Holmes. His report, his letter to the court, said that he was not able to render a medical opinion because of the inability to conduct a thorough evaluation. And what he explained in his first letter to the court was that was because it took him over 2 hours just to try and get a life history from Mr. Holmes. My understanding of what our examination of Dr. Olive would have led to was for him to explain to the court why it was that it was impossible to continue that evaluation. If it took him 2 hours to get a life history from Mr. Holmes, and as Dr. Olive says, not because Mr. Holmes wasn't cooperating, but because of the method by which Mr. Holmes communicates, made it impossible for Dr. Olive to continue with his evaluation. Our exploration of that issue would do two things. One, would explain why it was, in fact, that that's what was going on and explain why Dr. Olive was unable to meet that opinion or render an opinion. Second would be to support Dr. Bailey's findings, that if Dr. Bailey spent over 5 hours over a two-day period conducting his evaluation of Mr. Holmes, how it was that Dr. Bailey was able to conduct his evaluation compared to what Dr. Olive was able to do.
Now, Dr. Olive never says, this is a question, it's not a statement, that Mr. Holmes is dissembling or in other ways trying to make it look like he's worse off mentally than he is?
No, there's no accusation at all in this matter that there has been any issue of malingering. This initially came to our attention when Mr. Holmes stopped communicating with counsel. We received reports from the institution that there were problems with his behavior. We did not at that point have the resources from the court to employ an expert. We asked that the prison psychiatrist visit with Mr. Holmes and evaluate him.
But
and that
how
was
do
the
you
first
square this with the lucidity of this statement that he gave to Judge McKinney? He knew, you know, why he was there, sentenced to death, and this and that. It didn't seem me. And from the other quotations from Holmes, there's this long talk about the happiest day in his life and all that. It's strange. But he talks a lot, and he's opinionated, you know, and he wanders off. But I didn't see anything to suggest that he doesn't know what he's doing, doesn't know that he's on trial, and couldn't respond to his lawyers.
I would beg to differ. I think that the transcript clearly does demonstrate his inability to answer the questions. Specifically,
it's a judgment for the judge to make, isn't it? Isn't the best evidence, really, if the judge talks to the person, isn't that the best evidence of whether the person is competent?
Actually not. This court has specifically said that for a judge to rely on the statements of the person who is alleged to be incompetent, that they are in fact competent, is not the appropriate manner in which to determine that.
Why
because if they're competent, then saying that they're competent doesn't prove that they are.
I don't understand you.
I'm sorry, Judge?
I don't understand you. Suppose a person speaks to the judge, and then there are long quotations from his, there's a long transcript of statements by by Holmes at the competence hearing. And suppose he sounds perfectly lucid. Why would you go further?
Sounding lucid isn't necessarily competency.
I don't understand you. Suppose you gave this person a quiz, and you said, do you understand, you have to tell your lawyers everything that happened, and you have to, are there any witnesses to what you said, and what did you say to the police, and what did you say, in the restaurant, and this and that. Do you understand that you have to answer those questions, and can you answer them, and so on? Suppose the judge went through and asked him a lot of questions, all of which he answered like a normal person. Why would you want to go behind that?
You may not necessarily have to go beyond that. If the issue in front of the court is whether or not there's a prima facie indication of competency, and the trial judge or the district court judge does not find that the prima facie issue of competency has been met, there's no need to have the evaluation. We're well beyond that at this point.
We're not. You had evaluation. Doesn't mean that because you can hire a psychiatrist to say that someone is nuts, that necessarily has to, carry the day if the person appears to be normal.
But I thought there was lots of other pre-existing evidence that he actually had diagnoses of the schizophrenia and other disorders long before this hearing.
There was some medical and mental health history in the past. really became much worse in the fall and winter of 2002 when this issue first started to be litigated in the district court. It was at that point that we approached the district court with our suggestion of incompetency. Prior to that, there was no issue as far as we could identify of competency. There was issues of mental health issues going on, but there was not a question of competency, and it only became in, I believe, in December of 2002 when Mr. Holmes began to demonstrate extraordinarily bizarre behavior that was very different.
Is that when he stopped talking to you and thought that if he read papers, then they would be communicated to his enemies somehow?
That is the beginning of that thought ideation. He had, up until that point, had been very communicative with his lawyers, in contact with us on a regular basis. When you would meet with him, he would be well-groomed, cared for. Starting in about December of 2002, he stopped communicating with counsel. When we would visit him, he would present himself in a very disheveled, disorganized manner. It was that change in behavior which led us to question his competency and to approach and breach this issue with the district court. The evidence that we had obtained at that point, mostly coming through the prison's records themselves, his mental health care in the prison system, was such that when we brought this to the district court, the Attorney General agreed that we had met the prima facie issue as to a question of competency.
So, right. So you'd gotten past that first threshold and everybody agreed
yes.
with that. Now, it seems, looking at his exchange with Judge McKinney, that he was offering to become more cooperative again. Is that what's happened?
No.
Does he know you're here today?
Yes, he does. I met with, if the court would allow, I met
no,
with
Ms. You can't testify.
Well, I understand.
My
concern when the judge issued his opinion saying that Mr. Holmes had agreed to cooperate with his lawyers from that day forward, my concern and the issue with that is that we have no way of demonstrating that whether that's happening or not. And for the district court to predicate part of his finding of competency is that Mr. Holmes has not been reading his legal materials, has not been assisting in counsel, but he told me he would from this day forward. That, again, brings us into the problem.
Well, what is it exactly? So we're just talking about his competency to participate in the appeal. Is that correct?
We have two issues in front. One is the competency in the district court as our second assignment. We also have the competency to proceed in the habeas litigation from this point forward. And it isn't simply a question of competency to participate in the appeal to this court, although that is a big part of it.
Right, so that's a big part of it. Now, what kind of interactions does a person have with his appellate lawyer?
In a capital case, very different than most cases than in regular criminal cases.
Why?
Well, because in a capital case, there's more than just the appeal. We have to be investigating issues.
I'm talking about the appeal. I don't want the more than the appeal. What is the role of a criminal defendant in assisting his lawyer on appeal? Because this is not an issue. This is not a capital issue as such. You know, we could have a whole slew of litigation on ordinary criminal defendants who complain that they're incompetent. They want a hearing in order because they can't assist their lawyer on appeal.
That is correct. There is a bigger issue involved in this.
Right.
Although,
so just tell me concretely. I mean, you're obviously handling an appeal. So what is it that when you handle an appeal, what kind of interactions do criminal appellate lawyers have with their clients regarding appeals?
We have to consult with our clients as to the issues that we are going to raise, the issues that we are not going to raise, because if we don't raise particular issues, there are further consequences regarding waivers. There are tactical and strategical decisions regarding the presentation of the issues to be argued. What are we going to actually do? And you need to consult with your client on those matters.
Mr. Benz, in the perhaps usual case, in a competency setting, we have an expert on one side and one on the other, and quite often they come out with two different views.
That's correct.
So in this case, we don't have that. We have your expert obviously reaching the conclusion he did, and then we have the judge making his assessment on a given day.
Yes.
Which I guess you would argue was happened to be a good day, perhaps, for the exchange. And I'm not asking you to concede that, but for the judge to be able to reach his. If we had Dr. Owens reaching an opposite conclusion, which would be, as I say, quite often the case.
Yes.
It comes up not just in capital cases, but in all cases. And we had the judge making the assessment that he did in this case. Would you would still be arguing what? That the judge didn't have a sufficient basis because all he was really working on was today's inquiry and a contradictory
if in fact we'd had the hearing and the issues going to the merits of the competency evaluation, it would be as a regular appeal that we would have issues with the ultimate conclusions and finding by the district court and the standard of review on that. Our argument is that it's...
So Judge McKinney just doesn't have his expert aid, so to speak, which we find in
normal cases, yes, you would have a contrary opinion, and what you have in this case is a district court judge accepting the only expert opinion that is present for a certain set of conclusions, but on the ultimate issue, deciding to reject the expert's opinion based on the judge's personal interactions with the defendant in the courtroom on one particular day.
So if the case goes back and Dr. Olive spends a day rather than 2 hours and reaches a contrary conclusion to Dr. Holmes, and then Judge McKinney has whatever exchange, if he has one.
Ultimately, the question under the need to have the hearing and the proceedings, the due process question is presented, doesn't affect ultimately the outcome. We can still be before this court after those proceedings in the same posture that we are.
No, I didn't mean to say you couldn't preclude an appeal from that finding. But are you resting it today on the point that we've got an unusual case of a district judge making an inquiry on a given day? I'm not questioning the depth or scope of it. And dealing with only a contrary opinion.
Yes.
And that sets this case apart.
It does set it apart.
So what if we remanded and Holmes refused to talk to Oliver?
Well, I think given the history and the record that
no,
Holmes would...
No, question. Suppose that he refuses to talk to Oliver. Then what happens?
It does often happen, and Dr. Olive would issue...
What will be the legal posture of the case if he refuses to talk to Oliver?
It would be in the same position we're in today. Dr. Olive would not have an opinion.
And therefore,
we would be back where we started.
No. You don't understand my question. Suppose we remand, he refuses to talk to Oliver, you come back. Now, what would you argue? Would you argue that because Bailey said he was incompetent and Oliver offered no opinion, he's incompetent? That would be your argument?
And that is the argument that we make now and we would make then.
Now that would be ridiculous to make it then, because I would just say, well, the way you prevail in a case like this, you cooperate with your own with the defendant's psychiatrist, then you just refuse to talk to the government psychiatrist, and as a result, the only expert evidence is that you're incompetent.
I would expect that the court would consider the fact that you refused to cooperate with the state's expert as evidence that you are, in fact, not competent.
But that's ridiculous.
That you are competent.
Well, you're not. Make up your mind. It makes a big difference.
Your refusal to cooperate with Dr. Olive would be evidence that you are competent.
You would be arguing he refused because he's crazy.
I very well might be.
Well, I don't see where the remand that you're proposing is going. Well, why don't we move on to another issue? You can't spend all. I'd actually like to ask you about your other appeal. So your argument there, apart from the passing over the jurisdictional issue, your argument is that because of the Indiana Supreme Court's Saylor decision, it was a denial of equal protection for them to say that if it's a 10-2 vote against the death penalty, that doesn't necessarily require the judge to withhold the penalty. Right? Is that it, that the distinction between unanimous in Saylor and tended to in this case is the violation of equal protection?
That is correct. It's the disparate treatment of these two separate cases.
What if it's 9-3, 8-4, 7-5?
If the Indiana Supreme Court meant what it said in Saylor,
but answer my question.
Then it doesn't matter. As long as there is one vote for life in
really?
The jury verdict, under this Indiana Supreme Court's holding in Saylor, that defendant is entitled to a life sentence.
Let me ask you the question a little differently, because I thought you were saying, especially when I looked at your reply brief, that the broader message from Saylor was that the Indiana Supreme Court had decided that these 2002 amendments to the Indiana capital sentencing regime were going to apply. And even though the amended statute in subpart G still allows the trial judge to make the ultimate sentencing determination if the jury is hung, whether it's hung 1 to 11, 11 to 1, anywhere in between, either way, but that the Indiana Supreme Court was saying we're going to apply the new system across the board, including the special verdict findings, including other things that are apart from that, and arbitrarily to withhold it from a class of one, Holmes, mm-hmm. who they mentioned in Saylor, is the essence of your complaint. It's really not just the who decides point, that it was really the whole scheme.
Absolutely. That is correct. In Saylor, the Indiana Supreme Court announced that they were going to be applying backwards to capital cases the 2002 amendments to the Indiana statute.
And primarily, there's only one person at this point that's not happening for, right?
That is correct.
And so there's no floodgate, there's no nothing, there's no one else it could apply to, right?
No, there is nobody else on Indiana's death row that would apply to.
Okay, so we're really just looking at this unique case of Mr. Holmes.
And that's the foundation for the equal protection argument.
But the problem with that argument, even to get across the jurisdictional, the problem with that argument is the very strange basis on which the Saylor decision rests. Apparently the Indiana Supreme Court believes that it has been given a kind of clemency power so that it can decide. Remember the language, it keeps using the word inappropriate to describe the imposition of the death sentence when the law has been changed. Well, if the power the court is exercising is essentially a clemency power, then you can't really have an equal protection claim, right? If the governor of Indiana decided to pardon remit the death penalty for Saylor, Holmes couldn't argue that, well, you can't remit death penalty for one defendant and not others similarly situated, right? You can't challenge that. So how is this different?
It's different primarily because the Indiana Supreme Court doesn't have clemency power. It is
it
a judicial
does,
decision.
It does, because what was the legal rule that it was applying in Saylor's case?
It is the legal rule that the Indiana Supreme Court maintains jurisdiction over all cases in order to continue to exercise its equitable powers.
Aha, equitable powers. Now, you know, criminal law is not a part of equity.
That's correct.
So when you talk about equitable powers to cancel a death sentence, that sounds like clemency.
The problem is that when it comes through a court, it's acting on a rule of law, and it's operating under the Eighth Amendment. The equal protection problem flows into the Furman issue.
We're not talking about the Eighth Amendment. We're talking about equal protection. You think that the Saylor decision is based on the Eighth Amendment?
I think when you read Saylor, it's absolutely what the Indiana Supreme Court was doing.
It's inappropriate. What would be the violation of the Eighth Amendment?
Furman itself directs that it cannot be arbitrary and capricious. Taking Saylor off of death row.
What's arbitrary and capricious about saying that if the law changes, that'll benefit people in the future, not necessarily in the past?
There isn't anything arbitrary about that. It becomes arbitrary when the Indiana Supreme Court applies it retroactive to one death row.
No, we're talking about Saylor. We're not talking about this case. What is it in Saylor? How could Saylor have been based on the Eighth Amendment?
Saylor isn't.
What is it based on?
It is based on the Indiana Supreme Court's ongoing jurisdiction over all cases.
No, look, you don't base a decision on jurisdiction. You have jurisdiction, then you have to have some substantive doctrine or procedural doctrine. So what is the principle, the legal principle that was being applied in Saylor?
The legal principle was a basic concept of it's unfair to execute Saylor under the situation where he was sentenced to death on a scheme that is now not valid. It was an equitable decision.
Right. Okay.
And the problem is that they have then turned around and denied that same equity to Mr. Holmes.
Yeah. Want to reserve the rest of your time?
I'll reserve the rest of the time for my rebuttal.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Benza. Mr. Martin?
Good morning. May it please the court. The district court conducted a thorough and improper examination of Mr. Holmes' competency to pursue habeas relief and to pursue this appeal.
Why did the district court not actually have a hearing at which the experts were called?
I believe because he felt satisfied that Mr. Holmes was able to make the kind of decisions that he's required under the standard.
Usually, I mean, the way normal experts are used is they'll file their reports, but then, I'm sure you've been involved in many trials, the experts are put on the stand, there's cross-examination of the experts, there's exploration of the validity of their methodologies, you know, what did they do? The thought that there was absolutely nothing to be gained from further examination, whether in your case it might have been discrediting Dr. Bailey or on the other side's case it might have been figuring out that Dr. Olive wasn't really asking the right questions in the right way. I don't know what such cross-examination would have produced, but it's a little odd to me to think that something as complex as mental illness is capable of diagnosis or competency is capable of diagnosis by a lay person.
Your Honor, unquestionably, had there been testimony from the experts, it would have provided the opportunities that you described.
I'm just wondering why this is an adequate hearing without them. I'm certainly not prepared. I would never say that Judge McKinney had no right to question Mr. Holmes. I think there's no question that that's an appropriate part, but I'm very uncomfortable with the thought that, on your logic, he could have just called Mr. Holmes after all of this predicate had been laid. This is not a case where this was the first moment where anybody had a glimmer that there might have been something wrong with Mr. Holmes's competency. That, I think, is quite a different case, and judges need to make an initial judgment. That was long in the past by the time this hearing happens, and this court itself had said, we want you to conduct a competency hearing, and to do this truncated hearing is very troubling to me.
Your Honor, I believe that the order on remand from this court did not specifically require the district court to use expert evaluation, and I'm not suggesting by that it wasn't prudent or advisable to do so, but I think that the manner in which the district court did use the expert evaluations was reasonable in this instance, and I think particularly it's because the district court had not one but two opportunities, lengthy opportunities, over time to interact with Mr. Holmes and get the district court's own sense of Mr. Holmes' understanding of his situation and what confronted him and what the consequences were of his conviction and sentence, as well as his situation.
What was the duration of direct observation in those two hearings of Mr. Holmes?
Your Honor, in terms of actual time, I couldn't tell you precisely. I was present at the initial one.
Right.
And I would say that they probably consumed 3 hours And I can't
that
I can't
was
say
three
that
hours
I'm confident.
Of exchange between Judge McKinney and the defendant.
Over the course of the two different times that he testified.
Well, just break it out for me, however you will. But I'm just trying to get a sense, since you're going to rely, as you must, significantly on the judge's assessment. I mean, we have a transcript, but I'm just trying to get a view as of how much time was spent on this.
Your Honor, to be fair, I can only confidently say that I think it was around, I want to say, a couple of hours.
In both hearings?
A conservative estimate from the time that Holmes spoke in each of the hearings together would have constituted conservatively a couple of hours.
Now, do you have any concern that the judge proceeded in this fashion, that is, truncated, as Judge Wood has indicated, when he did not have at least competing views on competency? He had just a contrary view to the one he arrived at, perhaps appropriately.
Your Honor, I don't agree completely with that assessment. I think that there were competing observations and impressions that were related to the district court.
Why don't we get a conclusion from Dr. Rowland? Are we to read into his ability to get the history a degree of competency? Is that what you would have us do?
Dr. Olive was able to tell the district court that during his interaction with Holmes, he was able, that Holmes did not display any classic symptomology of schizophrenia, and that he didn't see anything that would suggest to him that Holmes was unable to understand his position legally, the fact that he had been sentenced to death, that the habeas petition was an opportunity.
Why does he stop short, then, of what I assume was his assignment?
Because, Your Honor, Holmes' refusal, and I characterize it as a refusal, Holmes' reluctance, whatever it was that motivated Holmes not to be completely forthcoming, caused Dr. Olive to be concerned about the completeness of his ability to offer diagnostic impressions. I think Dr. Olive was very candid about that. When a finder of fact, a judge sitting as a finder of fact over a matter like this, has to make a decision about competency, which involves legal considerations and the impact on the legal requirements of the actual mental abilities of the person involved, there are a number of things that the fact finder has to consider. And there were a lot of things here that supported the district court's decision that Holmes was competent.
So what had Mr. Benza requested in the way of further proceedings? Did he say that he wanted live testimony of the experts?
Your Honor, Mr. Benza did file a motion for the district court to reconsider its ruling, and I do believe that Mr. Benza did request additional hearing on the matter.
But I just wanted to point out, I mean, this court is sometimes polite in its orders, but I'm looking at August 10th, 2005. Our order does say, because the referenced affidavits are now over a year old, we suggest that the district court solicit contemporary affidavits from counsel and consider obtaining the opinion of an expert. So that's not, you know, a diktat to get expert testimony, but it's...
I agree with you,
it's
Judge.
It's pretty close to
that. I don't take issue with you there. And I think the district court also took that to heart.
And so he appoints the experts, so that means it's kind of a non-issue. But the experts are playing an important role in this.
They are. And as Mr. Benza suggested, this is not the first time that anyone has considered the character of Mr. Holmes' intellectual and mental capacities. And there were numerous mental health experts that testified about those issues at trial or at the post-conviction hearing. None of them suggested that Mr. Holmes suffered from a significant or ongoing psychosis.
Well, I'm sure, have seen. It is not unheard of, anyway, for people's mental health to deteriorate while they sit around on death row. And I think that was the issue, really. Maybe all of those earlier findings were fine and correct, and at the time of the trial and at the time of his state post-conviction, maybe he was still sufficiently hanging on to reality that he was all right. But if you're facing deterioration, things can change.
I mean,
up to, as the Supreme Court has noted, the time of execution in a Ford kind of claim.
Absolutely. I think that Mr. Holmes provided the district court with something that the district court could confidently conclude showed that he understood what these proceedings were about. And
what's the legal system supposed to do with somebody with, you know, bipolar conditions who can have an hour of lucidity and then can suddenly throw away all his legal files and go into some grandiose phase or other sorts of things? We're supposed to just kind of grab onto the little bits of time where there's lucidity?
Your Honor, hypothetically speaking, I think that when you're presented with a situation like that, that would probably be much more problematic when facing trial than it would be if the petitioner or the defendant is able to maintain periods of lucidity long enough and meaningful enough to make decisions, appropriate decisions. I think it would be okay, and that would satisfy the degree of competency necessary in a situation like this.
But let me suggest to you a very important decision that sometimes comes up in these capital habeas cases that I think a responsible lawyer would certainly want to run by his client. Sometimes people have the choice of raising arguments that will have the effect only of setting aside the sentence, or raising an argument that would have the effect of wiping the slate clean and starting all over again, where they might be subject to a new death sentence that is, you know, flawless, if you will, in terms of the procedures that have been followed. Strategically speaking, that's the kind of decision a client needs to be part of. You know, are we really just going to go for the sentence and have you spend your life in prison, or are you really just going to roll the dice big time and go for the conviction? So even though it's post-conviction, it strikes me that, wouldn't you agree, that's the kind of thing a lawyer needs to make sure he or she is following the client's wishes on.
I do agree, Your Honor. And I guess with respect to that, as long as a defendant, even if mentally ill, is able to exercise the necessary degree of lucidity to make a rational decision like that, even though it may not be ecstatic, a good way to describe it, it would still be sufficient.
But we have something like that possibly here, given that in his 06 filed case, he's talking about Saylor and seems to me arguably much more the sentence, whereas this large array of claims made in the 04 case, they strike me as going to the entire proceeding.
Yes, that's true. I think that the discussions that Holmes had with the district court support the conclusion that he has not indicated that he is unwilling to pursue any of the arguments or strategies that have been suggested to him by his counsel.
He seems very obsessed with this one argument that the state, I think with great force, says is not particularly strong about whether there was a valid indictment against him. He wanders off about that for pages.
Yes, he is excessively focused on that claim, which I think is not...
Well, this is a dream world, right? This person isn't going to have anything to say about appeal from denial of habeas corpus. You know, by the strange twists of the fate, habeas corpus is, along with immigration law, the most complicated area of federal law. And the notion that someone, whether he's sane, insane, is going to actually have... I mean, sure, as Judge Wood said, you may make a basic decision. Are you going to challenge the sentence, or do you want to put all your money on trying to get your conviction reversed? But beyond that, when it comes to picking out particular arguments, it just doesn't make any sense. I've never seen a case before in which someone... Has there ever been a non-capital case in which someone said that he wasn't competent to assist his lawyer in the appeal from denial of habeas corpus? Wouldn't make any sense, right? Because it just means he just rots in jail.
In my experience, I've never...
That case where anyone would want to do that, since they'd rather rot in jail than be executed.
Your Honor, I have not encountered one in my practice, and I'm not aware of any. But I just want to...
Mr. Martin, before your time runs out, and I'm sorry to jump around like this, but I wondered if you could comment in terms of the jurisdictional argument you've made in what I'm calling the 06 case, the more recent appeal, on the Supreme Court's decision in Panetti against Quarterman, which was just decided this June, which was a case in which they say that you can't just count petitions. They say the phrase second or successive is not self-defining. Just because it's the second in time doesn't mean it's second or successive. And they also rely on they discuss whether that particular person's actions were an abuse of the writ. So reading that case, it looks to me like one could say that this case is quite similar. That case happened to deal with a Ford claim, but a kind of a continuing claim of that couldn't have been raised earlier is what the court's talking about. So I just wondered what your view was on how that affects your jurisdictional argument.
Well, I think that our response to that, Your Honor, is that this is not a claim that couldn't have been raised earlier.
What if he's deteriorated? That's why I asked you that before. If his condition was fine back in 2003, but now it's 2007, and he's hypothetically, you know, I realize I'm not asking you to concede anything, but if hypothetically some people are certifiably, you know, babbling by that point, he really couldn't have raised that point in 2003. He's changed. You know, he himself has changed, and the legal proceedings grind on, as they have been in this case.
And so I'm understanding you correctly to say that he couldn't have authorized his attorneys to pursue that claim.
Well, that seems to me the kind of absurd thing the court was worried about in Panetti. If you think habeas counsel in 2003 should have thrown in a claim saying, we think in 4 years our client's condition may have deteriorated, and so if legal proceedings are still pending at that point, we would like to raise the argument that he's incompetent to assist counsel. That sounds like a very hypothetical claim the courts don't want habeas petitions cluttered with. You know, it sounds like the kind of claim that one should be able to raise at the time, if it ever arises, at the time it arises.
And I guess with respect to this attempt to apply Saylor to his circumstances.
Well, that's the merits, but I was just asking about jurisdiction. You know, he's saying jurisdictionally that Saylor is something new, and maybe we're getting to that. So why don't you go ahead? Yeah.
We believe that Saylor is nothing new post the initiation of these habeas proceedings.
But why was he denied permission to add his Saylor claim to his federal habeas? He asks for that before the district court makes its 2004 decision. If you look at it, it's actually similar to a case this court had years ago, also from Indiana, Mr. Burris's case. But soon after Saylor comes down, he asks that his initial petition, which was pending in the Southern District of Indiana at that time, be suspended because he wanted to raise his Saylor point. So there was a moment where he could have consolidated it all, and he's denied permission.
Your Honor, I was unaware of this. This was before the district court denied relief on this petition?
Right, before the 2004 decision. As I understand the record, now I'm certainly ready to be corrected, but my attempt to wade through this record suggests that that's what happened.
I apologize if I'm mistaken about that. That was not my understanding. But again, Saylor, as that relief from that holding of the Indiana Supreme Court, is not applicable to Mr. Holmes. Quite simply, the Indiana Supreme Court has decided to exercise its power under the Indiana Constitution through Appellate Rule 7 to conduct a manner of, and the way I would characterize it, Your Honors, is a proportionality review. They found it inappropriate to have someone who enjoyed a unanimous jury recommendation for something other than death be sentenced to death on a judicial override, even though the current statute as it exists would not allow that for someone who is going to be convicted and sentenced under the new regime.
So, I understand that distinction. I guess what worries me about it is the fact that Mr. Holmes is a class of one at this point. Now, I do think your opponent argues that there's a difference between executive clemency and the kind of authority, say, the Indiana Supreme Court is exercising under the Indiana Constitution. Courts are different institutions from executives. They do have to follow legal rules, and the Indiana Supreme Court, I don't think, under Supreme Court precedent, could suddenly say, well, we have this power, so we're just going to flip a coin every time somebody's case comes up, and we're going to decide it's appropriate sometimes and not appropriate other times. We would say that was capricious. We would say you can't do that. You have to have reasons, right?
Correct, and proportionality is one of the tenets of Indiana's appropriateness review. And if you have offenders who have been afforded relief, or rather, if you have offenders who have been sentenced under the current statutory regime and enjoyed a jury recommendation of something other than death.
Right. No, I understand that.
Could
you answer a question for me? We looked and couldn't find the jury instructions in the record, but it was my understanding from the briefs that the jury got an aiding and abetting instruction in both the robbery and the two murders. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
So is there ever any way of knowing whether Mr. Holmes aided and abetted by, let's say, blocking the door versus by actually stabbing? Is there a jury finding that could help us understand precisely what his role in the offense was?
There is no discrete jury finding on that, Your Honor.
So anything that counts as aiding and abetting under the instructions the jury got would have been enough to support these convictions. It's only when we get to the judicial findings of his role in the offense, which the state trial judge makes, that we begin to get at least what the judge thought the real scene was like.
That's correct, Your Honor. As long as, and it is the case here, the statutory aggravators were found by the jury, which were the robbery aggravator and the multiple murder aggravator.
Right, the multiple murders. But my point is, within the multiple murders, since there was an aiding and abetting instruction, it could have been that the jury found aiding and abetting the murder, and it just would have come out as murder. Whereas for the aggravators, maybe more precision is necessary. I mean, maybe you just drove the car. I mean, there. It seems to me there are many things that might have counted as aiding and abetting that might not be bad enough to be the statutory aggravators.
Well, I think the major participation concept has to be satisfied.
But and was the jury told that for aiding and abetting? That's where the instruction. I don't know if you still have a copy of the instructions, if you could refer us to where they are,
Your Honor,
in this record.
I do not. I don't know if Mr. Benza has a copy with him or
I
not.
I think they might be at this court, but the record is in a bit of disarray. I'm sure, obviously, it's an old one. But it strikes me that this is important for making sure that there is the kind of jury finding that the current regime would be interested in there was the right kind of question asked to the jury such that the move the Indiana Supreme Court then decides to make when the Saylor point is made. They say, well, the jury found the statutory aggravators in this indirect way. I'm not so sure that they did. I'm not so sure they were asked to find what you just said, the major participation.
I apologize for not having a better grasp of the jury instructions to assure you that they were. It is my belief that they were instructed that they had to find that degree of participation beyond a reasonable doubt, but I cannot tell you that the
Well,
jury
there
instructions.
Is an instruction 48 that speaks to the aiding and abetting, but I'm not sure that it confirms that Holmes personally had the intent to kill. Which I guess is...
I'm almost certain, Your Honor, again, unable to recite or direct you to something chapter and verse, that the jury was instructed that Holmes had to intend that the victims die. I'm nearly certain of that. If the court does not have any further questions, I'm ready to answer the court's questions with regard to any of the numerous issues that have been brought in this appeal. But if the court is satisfied, then I would rest on the arguments that are in the state's brief.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Mark.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Benza, how much time does he have? 4 minutes? So, Mr. Benza, in the 05, you didn't say anything about his competence. So is that not an issue in the 05 appeal?
In the 05 appeal, the situation we faced was we had already had a judicial determination that he was competent to go forward.
But you're challenging it.
We are, but we were in that position. As we are...
Why aren't you challenging it in this appeal?
Because it's already part of the 04 appeal.
These are two different appeals.
They are. And if this court finds that he's competent or not competent, then I may have made a tactical error in not litigating that issue in the 05 case as well.
Well, so what is the posture? Is it waived? Is it somehow that even if we reversed the other case, or not reversed it, remanded for a further competence hearing, we nevertheless should consider 05 to be... ripe for decision on the merits?
They're going to take away my criminal defense lawyer card when I say this, but yes, I've waived it by not raising it in the 05 case.
There's another thing that's kind of strikes me as odd about this.
Could I just nail that down for a second? So you are saying that you have raised it in 04-3549, but that in your 06-2905 case, that's not a point. So if we, for some reason, rejected everything that you have to say in the 04-3549 case, it's not there anymore. Is that what you just said?
The competency question is not there.
The competency question. Okay.
That is correct.
But you regard it as still, since we've consolidated these two cases, it's still before us under the number 04-3549.
That is correct.
Okay.
Wait, I'm lost now. what are you saying?
I think he's saying he's not waiving it altogether because it's before us in number 04-3549. But if we reject every argument he's made in 04-3549 and say you lose on everything, and then we turn to 06-2905, then the competency issue isn't before us anymore. Once having resolved it in the 04 case,
I don't understand that. I mean, he's taken two separate appeals. In one of the, I don't think consolidating appeals does not affect the issues that are before the court. He's taken two separate appeals, and one of them he challenges competence. The other he doesn't. And he's sin. The other he's waived. I mean, it's weird, extremely weird, but it seems to me he doesn't have a competency ground for our not deciding 05. This is what you just said. Strange.
And arguably, that is correct.
But look, the other thing that's so odd about this, it seems to me when you argue competence of your client to assist you on appeal, you shouldn't brief any other issue.
That is absolutely correct.
You shouldn't brief any other issue because you've put before us a whole bunch of issues which, according to you, do not reflect an ability of your client. I mean, you went ahead and you filed a bunch of issues, which maybe he doesn't want. He didn't want those issues.
We are placed in that position by the district court's findings.
You can just appeal and you can just file and say, look, sent back for competence here. You believe this person is not competent to assist you. Look, suppose there were an issue about whether you even represented defendant. Well, we would have to resolve that issue before you filed your brief for the person. So similarly, if there's a challenge to competency of the client to consult with the appeal, shouldn't that issue be litigated separately from the merits?
In an ideal world, yes. In our legal system, it is not.
But surely, when you appeal,
I think the problem is waiver if you don't win on the competency. At some point, you have to accept the court's answer, and then you wouldn't want to have waived all the rest of the issues.
That's absolutely correct.
Yes. If we held that he was competent, then...
then he'd want to raise all his other issues.
You'd file your brief, but... but presumably,
And that was not this court's order to us, was to brief only the competency issue.
Curious, I shouldn't have raised. But look, so last a point about Dr. Olive. Now, Dr. Olive did say that he does display symptoms of schizophrenia or schizotypal, never heard of that before, paranoid. Such symptoms do not appear to compromise the particular competencies currently at issue. Couldn't the judge think that Dr. Olive, he was being cautious, he's being honest. That was a mistake, right? She just said flatly, this guy's competent. But he decides to be honest, recognize these psychiatrists know very little, actually, about people's competence, and deciding, and couldn't the judge infer that as best as Dr. Olive can figure out, which is always highly limited, the fellow is competent?
He could have. He specifically said he was not. His letters to the court specifically were prefaced with the statement, I am unable to render a medical psychological opinion as to Mr. Holmes' mental state. Everything
and after, he doesn't say he's not doing that because of lack of cooperation.
No, he says he's unable to reach a medical opinion. And that's that. At that point, everything else in his letters to the court is irrelevant for a competency finding because it's not a medical opinion.
So, Spencer, if there were a remand in a hearing, you want to know from Dr. Valve why he cannot, professionally, why he cannot? That's what you want?
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't mean to preclude you wouldn't ask him something else, but
I absolutely want to know why he thinks why he was unable to complete his evaluation, because I think it's important. As Judge Posner pointed out, if he refuses to cooperate, isn't that something that could be interpreted against him? I don't know why. We don't know why Dr. Olive was unable to complete his evaluation. It's only by having him on the stand, having him explain that situation, that we're able to understand what happened.
What if we had no experts? We just had the Judge McKinney inquiry. He chose not to...
not to follow not the court's... remand?
Well,
I think the problem that we have is that the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Pape versus Robinson that when you have a legitimate question of competency, you have to have medical opinions. Competency is a legal conclusion, but it's predicated on a medical condition. And you cannot do that final conclusion without having a medical opinion. If I may, just in conclusion, I would direct the court to our Claim 7, which is the issue.
Understanding about insane people. There are very few people who are globally insane. So if a person is schizophrenic, he still pays his bills and he still crosses at the traffic light and so on. So there's no necessary connection between being insane and being able to deal not with all problems of life, but with many of them.
That's absolutely correct. You can be schizophrenic and be fully competent. Our position is Mr. Holmes is both paranoid schizophrenic and incompetent.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Benson. Of course, we appreciate your accepting the appointment in this case and all the time and effort you've made for your case. The case will be taken under advisement.